Welcome to our Goldster Podcasts, where we take you behind the scenes with authors of many different writing styles. I'm Lucinda Hawksley. I hope you enjoy this episode. If you want to find out more, go to www.goldster.co.uk and don't forget to subscribe to the podcast. Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the Goldster Inside Story. I'm absolutely thrilled today to welcome Philip Clark, who is a musician and a music journalist. And it's really great to have you here today on Goldster, Phil. So thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me. It's great to be here.
So tell us, first of all, what was it about music? Did you always have a love of music?
Yeah, my first memory as a child is actually listening to Dave Brubeck. My dad is a painter. And he used to paint every night to Dave Brubeck.
Wow. And
from the age of sort of three, four, or five, I was just instantly sort of drawn into the sound world of it. And the family mythologies, I used to run into his studio and dance at a blue Rondo a la Turk, which is a kind of horrible thought now, I have to say. But yeah, so it was just a sort of instant a connection. And I was brought up in the northeast of England, no a connection to America at all. No link. It was just it spoke to me. And, you know, this was sort of 1980s, late 70s and 1980s, as Sunderland of all places, just sort of jazz just communicated.
Yeah.
Over that distance of sort of time, you know.
And so what led you to become a music journalist? Because I know you're a musician as well, which I'd love to talk about later. But how did you start in the journalism?
Simply, I needed to make some money. it was as mercenary as that. And I was composing, and I'd won a competition run by Classic CD magazine, which was a composing competition. And Dave Brubeck again. He's there everywhere. He was touring the UK, and I got to know him by that point. And I was going to meet up with him. And I emailed. No, I didn't email. I rang in those days the editor of Classic CD and said, "I'm going to see Dave Brubeck. Would you like an interview?" And he said yes immediately. And to this day, I remain convinced he thought I was somebody else. because I had no journalistic experience at all. And I think it was a sort of 800 word a piece he wanted, and I think it took me about 2 months. It just and it's the sort of thing these days, you know, I would sort of write in an hour, but just the process of I had this sort of a long interview that I had to transcribe, and I didn't know how to do that, and then just to write the piece, and then of course it was much too long, so I had to sort of compress it. So, you know, it took me a long, long time, and then I kind of assumed, you know, that'd be it really. And then he actually rang a week later and said, "What are you doing for us next month?" And I wrote a piece about Charles Mingus, and the whole thing just sort of spiraled and snowballed out of that really. And I sort of only wrote about jazz to begin with, and then as soon as I was writing about classical music, and I got into other magazines and papers, and then I thought eventually I'm actually making a living at this.
That's got to be the best way into journalism I've ever heard. One article, and then they just say, "What are you doing for us next month?" I'm so envious.
It was just shameless opportunism. I mean, what can I say? It wasn't nepotism. It was just opportunism.
Good for you. So, how did you get to know Dave Brubeck then? We'll get onto the biography in a bit, but how did this begin?
It began, I was a student. I did my undergraduate work at Huddersfield University, which had a reputation for new music. I was very interested in sort of avant-garde composition, and I still am. And they have a fantastic festival every November. And when I was there, people like Stockhausen came, and Tippett and Elliot Carter and Yanis Xenakis, all these amazing sort of, figureheads. And in my first year, I think it was at Huddersfield, Dave was playing in Manchester. And I simply wrote to him and sent him a piano piece I'd written that was actually a sort of about Thelonious Monk. It wasn't about him particularly, and I wrote to him and sent him a cassette of the piece. It was a cassette in those days, of course, and I think I probably sent him a score and a letter. Didn't hear anything back, and I thought, there it is. And at the interval of the concert, I saw his manager, And I just went over to him and said I'd sent a Dave a letter. And he said, oh, yeah, Dave, I got it. Literally, as we were leaving, you know, they were leaving his house, and the postman arrived, and I took all the mail and put it in his suitcase. Mm-hmm. And Dave, you know, has listened to your piece and everybody likes it and wanted to see you afterwards. So as a Dave's wife, I took me backstage afterwards, and Dave was, you know, he was the reason I became a musician, and he was my idol, and he was absolutely as I thought he would be. He was so warm and welcoming, and he'd actually written down a few chords from the piece which he played. There was a sort of duffed up upright. This was in the Free Trade Hall in Manchester, which is now a hotel, I believe. He had played some chords I'd written and said how much he liked it. And then he said at the end, it was like a 10-minute meeting, I guess. And at the end, he said, keep in touch. And I thought that, you know, that's just something he probably says to everyone, is it never going to happen? And the next time I had something finished, I sent it to him, and he wrote that back, you know, a week later. And it just sort of went on from there, really. So we used to write to each other, and I'd send him stuff, and he'd comment. And then when I was, you know, thinking about, you know, I need to make a bit more money, he was out touring, and, you know, and that's where the connection was, you know, was made between him and their journalism.
Brilliant. Well, I want you to tell us about your biography. Actually, I want you to tell us all about who Dave Brubeck actually was, because many of us, you know, myself included, before I started looking at your book, may not have any idea. And he's obviously a huge influence on you. So.
I mean, I can read a bit to begin with, perhaps, as a way in. And then I'm just going to have a swig of water.
So Dave's going to be talking, Phil's going to be talking about his book, Dave Brubeck, A Life in Time. I'm going to put a link in the chat for those of you who are here live. And it's available in all good bookshops and online.
Indeed. Just a scene set a little bit. The book is pegged around a tour that Dave did in, I've forgotten, gosh, I should know that, in 2003. And I spent 10 days on the road with him, shadowing his group. And then we do these long interviews on the way to gigs and on the way home from gigs. And the first chapter of the book is called On the Road. Each chapter is named after a great American novel, and On the Road, it just seemed, you know, it's the Jack Kerouac novel, obviously, and it just seemed to symbolize Dave's life as a musician who you know, he has spent an incredible amount of time on the road, and the book actually begins with a quote from Kerouac. This is the story of America. Everybody's doing what they think they're supposed to do, and again, Dave just spent his life doing the thing he thought he was supposed to be doing. So it just absolutely, you know, sort of slotted into place. And then there are 10 chapters, and for each of the chapters, that, you know, having set that expectation up at the beginning with a quote, I then had to find another 9 quotes, which sometimes that wasn't easy, but anyway, I got there. So this is the beginning of the book. An opulently upholstered private bus, which 24 hours earlier was ferrying the English cricket team as somewhere between a disaster and triumph, turns the corner onto Park Lane in central London as Dave Brubeck, the jazz pianist and composer, 82 years old, rests on a cushioned sofa in an alcove at the rear of the vehicle. Wearing a burgundy shirt and cream linen suit, those signature horn-rimmed glasses of the 1950s, long since traded in for chunkier, light reactive spectacles, he has entered a heightened state of anecdotal nirvana. Brubeck is leading his quartet towards their next gig and is reminiscing about Charlie Parker, Leonard Bernstein, and gangsters. When Al Capone, I won't try and imitate Dave's voice, when Al Capone kidnapped Caesar Petrillo, Brubeck muses, referring to the occasion when the mob snatched the all-seeing head honcho of the American Federation of Musicians and held him for ransom. It was Joe Glazer who arranged his release. And Dave had naturally knew Joe Glazer, the dollar-fixated jazz and entertainment impresario, whom even a Louis Armstrong would greet referentially as Mr. Glazer. Joe Glazer was Dave's agent and manager in the 50s and 60s. At the very name at the very mention of a Glazer's name, and a wolf whistle cuts across at the rhythmic plod of the bus as it powers through South London. A melodic fanfare that implies, "Wow, Dave, now you're talking." After 20 years of killing time on the Brubeck band bus, a lifestyle I guaranteed to test anyone's tolerance ever hearing that same story once too often, Bobby Militello, Brubeck's long-serving saxophonist, is a lucky man. His boss is a memory bank who keeps on withdrawing nuggets of jazz history, and with a thirsty smile, he leans in to eavesdrop. It's April 23rd, 2003. Tonight, at the latest incarnation of the Dave Brubeck Quartet, will be performing in Brighton, the East Sussex coastal town affectionately nicknamed by its locals, London by the Sea. That the Dave Brubeck Quartet is still performing anywhere is, let's be honest, nothing short of miraculous. The revolutions in sound brokered during the 1950s and 60s by the Miles Davis Quintet, the Thelonious Monk Quartet, Art Blakey's Jazz Messengers, and the Ornette Coleman Quartet, the Modern Jazz Quartet, the Charles Mingus Jazz Workshop, and the John Coltrane Quartet, endure as a defining moments in jazz history. And Brubeck's Quartet is the last surviving name band from that golden era that is still going about his business. The earliest version of his quartet carved its own first grooves into history in August 1951, when the pianist and his musicians, including alto saxophonist Paul Desmond, the player with whom Brubeck would become most associated, walked into a San Francisco recording studio and cut four tracks: George Gershwin's A Foggy a Day, and Somebody Loves Me, and two original Brubeck compositions. Those experiments with what Brubeck invariably referred to as odd time signatures are the work that defined him, and which came to fruition on his 1959 album Time Out, were a whole 8 years into the future. But already in 1951, we hear the Brubeck Quartet reshaping the fundamentals of jazz around the leader's own ideas about rhythm and harmony, and about how improvisation can flourish inside a music that also placed a premium on inventive composition. Time Out, which spurned the hit single Take Five, was released at the end of 1959 and appeared in record stores alongside Miles Davis's Kind of Blue, John Coltrane's Giant Step, Charles Mingus's Mingus Arum, and Ornette Coleman's The Shape of Jazz to Come, which were all recorded within an implausibly fertile few months during 1959. How's that?
That's really good. Well, that sets the scene brilliantly.
Yeah.
What did it feel to be touring with them? Am I right that you went on the tour with them in 2003?
Yeah. I mean, I don't want to sort of overplay it and say I went to every single gig and like live with them, which I didn't. But yeah, I went to, I can't remember how many gigs. I think there were sort of 8, 9 gigs. And I think I went to about sort of perhaps 5 or 6 of them. And they would come, you know, they lived in Connecticut, they would come to London, and they hired a sort of a service flat, a thing in Maida Vale. And I would go, to Maida Vale every morning, perhaps have, a cup of tea or something. And then we get on the coach. And, you know, that first, night was Brighton. So actually, I'd be probably left at lunchtime. But there was a Manchester, I remember Leeds. And, and those journeys were incredibly long, obviously. Mm. So it was the perfect opportunity just to stick my recorder on and just talk. And then on the way back as well, we sort of talked into the night. And at the time I was writing for a jazz magazine, and I know the idea was it was for a sort of 3,000 word article, sort of catching up, about Dave's recording activities and about his, where he was now. But he gave me hours and hours and hours and hours of material, most of which, until I started the book, I hadn't even listened to, because, the way it worked You know, the tour, you know, sort of finished on a Tuesday or whatever it was, and I had to have the piece into the magazine by the Thursday. So I just basically had to just go to the stuff, you know, I wanted, and most of it I hadn't listened to, you know. So this was at 2003. I started at the book around 2018, 2019. And they were just, you know, this was long before the days of digital recorders. So they were literally, you know, not reel to reel cassettes, but, you know, cassettes, a TDK cassettes. Mm-hmm. And I guess I was very lucky they'd actually survived all that long and were in a good nick. I mean, can you imagine?
Wow, I can. It's like the stuff of nightmares for any author, the idea of it not surviving. So when you started, because by the time you started writing it then, Dave Rebecca died, is that?
He died, yes. So I'd sort of made a few earlier attempts to begin the book when he was still alive. And his wife, Iola, was, you know, she was a fantastic on email. She had a sort of AOL account. And if there were any sort of questions, I used to email him via Iola, and Iola would sort of talk to him and then shoot an answer back, you know, normally within an hour. And that first version of the book just didn't happen for various reasons. It didn't sort of work and didn't sort of, but the fact I'd sort of had this, you know, this sort of engagement and all these sort of answers, that really helped. When I was actually, you know, when I was writing at the book as it came to be. And then I started it, and then, you know, sort of children started to appear in my life. And then my mum got very sick, and for various reasons it didn't happen. And then I became aware that Dave's centenary was looming in 2020. And it sort of coincided with a point where I was slightly getting fed up of music journalism. I'd done it for 20 years, and it's a relentless cycle of, you know, it's a, you know, the magazines are a monthly cycle, and the newspapers even less, of course. And it's, you know, it's a kind of draining. And I really wanted, you know, to do another thing, and you know, Dave's centenary was approaching, so I just got it all together. I wrote a proposal and got the commission, and just off I went.
Brilliant. Yeah. So tell us some great stories. I mean, whether they're memories of yours or stories that Dave told you that you've managed to put into the book.
Gosh, well, I mean, there's so many. I mean, one story which perhaps, you know, gives an indication of what he was like. I remember going to see him in a hotel off at Piccadilly Circus. I mean, it wasn't a kind of, you know, like a Premier Inn in Dalston or something, but it was a pretty, you know, as hotels on Piccadilly go, it was a pretty modest hotel. And I just remember he had this sort of a duffed up, sort of a crappy, sort of a 2-octave electric keyboard, which is the thing he used to, you know, to work on, basically. And I remember him, you know, he had played me something he was there writing, and we talked about it. And then he said, I use this keyboard and a headphone because I don't want to disturb other people. And I just thought, oh my gosh, you know, it's a very sort of small example, of what he was like. But he was incredibly modest, incredibly sweet. He absolutely knew how good he was and how important he was as a musician, but he wore it incredibly lightly. And I can think of certain other jazz musicians who would arrive in a hotel in Piccadilly and sort of demand a choice of three, you know, sort of a Steinway grand pianos in their suite, and they would try them and send them away and demand another one. But he absolutely, you know, he absolutely wasn't like that. And you know, when my children were born, they sent stuff, and you know, he was just a complete delight. But it was interesting, you know, because I got to know him when he was in his 70s, and he was sort of, you know, he was sort of everyone's sort of kindly grandpa at that point. He didn't sort of have the Werther's Originals in his pocket, but that was the sort of that was the sort of vibe. But it was interesting writing the book and just realizing how incredibly tough he could be, particularly, you know, as starting out. So I mean, his first records were made for a very small independent label on the west coast of America, called a Fantasy Records, and all the early classic records are on that label, things like a Jazz at Oberlin. And then there was this suggestion. He met a record producer, George Avakian, who was a very important record producer. And George Avakian worked for a Columbia Records, which at the time was sort of, it was the biggest record company in the US, a sort of like the Penguin Books of American record companies. And George was, George just sort of, he just sort of heard Dave's magic and realized where he could take it, and assigned him, or wanted to sign him to a Columbia. But Dave, absolutely, he wouldn't sign at the contract until every little thing was, all the I's were dotted, the T's ever crossed. He got exactly what he wanted. And he very nearly blew it. One of the reasons why I had so much access when I was writing the book to rehearsal tapes and things, as an example, was he insisted that in that earlier contract in 1954, he insisted that any of his records at the copyright came back to him after the record had recouped for the label, which was completely unheard of. I mean, Miles Davis didn't get that. Duke Ellington didn't have that. And that was simply, and that was why when I was writing about Time Out in the book, I was able to listen to all the rehearsal tapes, because after a Time Out had recouped, the copyright had went back to Dave, and therefore he was able to get all the tapes back.
How amazing, because normally you hear about music industry really kind of having harsh contracts and musicians never doing well out of it. So he obviously did an incredible job.
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to say that, a Columbia shafted Miles Davis or anything, which they certainly didn't. I mean, he dealt with them very fairly. But I just thought, he wasn't a nobody at all, but he was a kind of middle sort of ranking jazz musician, sort of about to break through, and, being signed to Columbia was, certainly the route to do that. But he absolutely sort of wouldn't do it unless it was on his own. It was on his own terms,
Brilliant. Wow. Mm. And so when you first met him that time after you'd sent him your own composition, did he help you at all with your composition? Did you talk about that much?
Yeah. He wouldn't claim he taught me or anything. He used to send, a very encouraging letters about, which is sort of, being a composer is a, it was a thankless business then. God knows what it's like now when you hear about all the cuts in sort of a BBC Arts and all the rest of it. But it's a thankless task. And just to get a letter, from someone of, that weight to say, this is fantastic. And I particularly like the way he used to pick the harmonies apart at times and say, I really like how you overlay that B flat a chord with a D minor, and that's a really sort of interesting relationship, and sort of concentrate on that in your next piece. It was that a kind of thing, but actually, it was just more having the support, actually.
Of course, yeah.
And just having these sort of having these sort of letters in the post, which were very encouraging.
So to go back to your early career, so tell us about your life as a musician and composer.
Well, I did undergraduate work at Huddersfield University, and then I did a master's and a PhD at Sussex University with a fantastic composer called Michael Finnessy, who's one of the great British composers, I think. And all my compositions were essentially about trying to reconcile the worlds of sort of the worlds I've been experiencing the thing you might call avant-garde composition with improvisation. That was the thing I was always kind of chiseling away at. Finding ways to write pieces where things were at the same time incredibly controlled, but also, loose enough that, that people could take them and sort of work on them in an improvisational way within their performance. And I found actually, with a few honourable exceptions, most of the classical musicians absolutely hated that idea. The idea that they might have to actually input something that's not in the score. You know, they really didn't like that. So, you know, I learned, you know, I sort of learned at the hard way about that. I won a big competition and did a piece for the BBC Symphony Orchestra that was, and it was all about, and it sort of come back, I really, but it was all about the urban experience and in their cities and being in a city and sort of losing myself in a city and walking around, you know, the city and seeing, you know, the same things from different vantage points and just actually enjoying being lost in the city. I sort of really liked it. So I did that, and then I sort of I started increasingly working with jazz musicians and improvisers. I did a big piece for the London Jazz Festival about Thelonious Monk, a sort of a piece, you know, about trying to engage with his sound world. But again, it was a written out, but it was for jazz and musicians, and there were bits within the piece where the improvisers could, you know, kind of break out of the structure and do their thing. And then I started writing pieces entirely for improvisers. And obviously there's a, you know, there's a sort of massive contradiction there because improvisers improvise and they don't need their composers. And eventually I became an improviser. It was almost a destined. And in a way, I wish I'd sort of made that leap a lot earlier. It was always sort of there somehow. Right. And you know, certainly my teacher, Finnessy, he sort of felt it much earlier than I did. And he sort of said, what took you so long? It was almost like kind of coming out, you know. you know, the fact, the thing is, I really enjoyed the craft of writing and music and writing scores. And I sort of really enjoyed that. But ultimately, it sort of wasn't what I wanted to do. It was to actually make sound. And then recently, I worked with a percussionist, Eddie Prevo, who was in a very famous improvisation group called AMM. And he used to run a Friday evening a workshop, which was about a really... It was a space in which musicians were invited to come and leave everything they knew at the door about how to play their instruments and just sort of rethink a technique and the craft of instruments and how you relate, you know, instrument to instrument.
That's amazing.
Yeah, it was a really eye opening. And, you know, I used to do gigs off the back of that. And then I started writing the book and was going to go back to the improvisation and workshop after the book, and then the pandemic struck, and you can work out at the rest. So that was my, you know, that's my sort of a potted history of my life as a musician.
And so when you're writing, when you're writing your books,
yeah,
how does it differ as a discipline from when you're writing music?
I don't think it does. I think it's, I sort of see the books as scores in a way. It's sort of, you know, it's sort of working out. Well, I mean, you know, a lot of the ideas about structure and how you research a material and you structure it over a large canvas, over a sort of overarching scale, it's not that different whether it's words or sounds, really. And, you know, the way one thinks about, you know, a pacing of material, the way you think about... the way you think about, you know, the different types of material that have to be in a piece of music or a big book like this. You can't just have sort of one, a type of writing, you know, that starts on page one and ends on page 400, whatever it is. You bore the pants off everyone. So you have to have, you know, within this a book, there's, you know, there is some sort of dry factual reportage that Dave Brubeck met Paul Desmond for the first time in. But there's, you know, there's a bit where I sort of chase an idea across at the page. There's some sort of quite sort of a poetic a reflections. You know, you need a lot of different sorts of writing, a lot of different sorts of material. And my background in composition absolutely, you know, sort of put me in good stead to, you know, to create these large, you know, structures on the page. And interestingly, journalism is almost at the opposite of that. You know, you begin with everything you know, about sort of Gustav Mahler, and I compress it into 800 words. And writing a book like this is absolutely the opposite, because you begin with what you know, and then you sort of work outwards from there. And of course, you're trying to find out through research as much as you can. So yeah, I think, yeah, I do see them as, you know, it's all about how Tate ideas and relationships are between sort of sound and a society or whatever. It's a sort of the same thing.
Fascinating. I love that idea that it's such a similar process, writing music and writing books, because I'm not musical at all. So to me, it's amazing to me that you can do both.
I mean, I don't want to say if you're not a musician, you can't write books, because obviously that would be nonsense. but that was my, you know, that was my sort of very sort of personal experience of that. You know, that's how it worked for me.
So let's move on to your next, the other book that you worked. So you worked with Dave Davis from Kinks, very exciting.
Yes.
On his autobiography, Living on Thin Line.
Yes.
Tell us what that was like. How did that come about? Did you know him, like you, Dave Brubeck, or did you?
No. Well, it was another kind of a shameless, opportunistic fluke, which, you know, my career has basically been about that. Well, I interviewed Ray Davis, his illustrious brother. Ray had produced a disc of sort of choral versions of Kinks hits, the Kinks choral collection. And at the time I lived in East Finchley, at Muswell Hill in North London, and the Kinks studio was not so far from there. And I went to interview Ray. And then about a month or 2 months later, I was standing in a cafe on the high street in East Finchley, looked up at the guy next to me and thought, oh, you know, bloody hell, that's Dave Davis. So I introduced myself, and for some reason, I'm not absolutely certain why, we were already following each other on our Twitter, and he'd liked my cat photographs.
just that kind of rock and roll lifestyle that you liked your cat photos on Twitter, and you knew that this was going to be a rock and roll friendship.
Exactly. So anyway, we talked for about 20 minutes. And remember, we talked about cats and about jazz. And that was it. I mean, it wasn't like we kept in touch after that. But that was sort of fate, you know, kind of sealing the deal in a way. Sorry, I was going to... And then when I finished the Brubeck book, I went back and did a bit of journalism again and sort of, you know, it's all right, but I don't really want to do this again. And I simply sent him a DM on Twitter, saying, because he wrote an earlier memoir that came out about 97. And actually 97 is an important date in the history of the Kinks, because it's when the Kinks have finally kind of crashed and burned, really. And, you know, it was a very out of date. And I just DM'd him and said, are you interested in a collaboration on an update?
Wow, brilliant.
Of the book. And actually his girlfriend replied, Rebecca, and said, Dave has been thinking about this for a long time, almost did it a year ago, and for various reasons it fell through. So I met up with him and his manager. So this would have been February. I remember it was my birthday, so it was February the 9th, 2019. We met in Highgate and talked it through, and then I'd sort of drew up a little proposal thing and got it commissioned. And then again, just as we started, the pandemic hit, so we actually started it over Zoom.
Yeah.
And I thought, my goodness, he's 73. He's a rock star. Is he going to really be up, you know, for using a Zoom? Is he going to want to Zoom at sort of 3 o'clock in the morning, sort of high on whatever? But no, we talked every Thursday, I think it was at first, of a Zoom for 2 hours. And and actually it was a fantastic way to get the book started, because, you know, to do 2 hours of interview on Zoom just takes 2 hours. You don't have to go anywhere. You know, I don't have to go to London or whatever. So that we did that for sort of 2 or 3 months. And then when all the restrictions were lifted in, I can't remember, in sort of May, whatever it was, we started to meet every week. And, you know, And he would, you know, he'd record long, long, long interviews. Obviously all his sort of musical history, and he's a very interested in our spirituality. So we used to talk a lot about that. And also, I mean, one of the most interesting aspects of the book for me is him talking about living in Muswell Hill just after the war. And you actually realize just, my goodness, you know, the London, you know, we know now bears no relation to sort of, you know, sort of post-war London, and his descriptions of Muswell Hill and sort of, you know, sort of outside, you know, outside loos, and sort of, you know, sort of a bathing in sort of, you know, sort of tin, a bath with his mother, sort of a pouring hot water on them, and all that kind of stuff. And just how, you know, for people of my generation, it's easy to forget just how scarred London was by the war, and, you know, and him sort of playing in, I mean, I don't suppose there were ruins in Muswell Hill itself, but certainly sort of playing amongst the sort of, you know, the sort of rubble and the ruins in central London. And just this whole idea of just trying to, you know, sort of trying to build a life and trying to build an art out of the, you know, sort of out of the rubble of, you know, of that a catastrophe. I mean, he was a sort of firsthand a witness of that. So, you know, I mean, I came to adore him. He was just so sort of, you know, a bit like the other day, if he was so sort of generous with his time, and so, I mean, so incredibly open, and we both cried, we both laughed. You know, it was a fantastic experience. One of the great kind of privileges of, you know, of my life, just to sit there with someone of that magnitude and just to talk about music, and wow, have a weekly appointment to do so.
I'd have been quite starstruck. I wonder if anybody listening today has got any memories of the Kinks or anything. I know that I would have thought that was really amazing to meet somebody, you know, who I'd admired all that time.
Yeah, no, and I have to say, I'd give him, you know, we'd meet every Thursday, and I'd give him, you know, what I'd done the previous week, and he'd mark it up, and he never dropped a beat. He was always, you know, 11 o'clock a Thursday, bang, he was always there. He was just fantastic to work with. One hears sort of terrible stories of, you know, the sort of situations that are going wrong. But no, he was a fantastic and completely honored and completely honest and completely open. And I found a lot of mistakes in the earlier memoir that I managed to sort of iron out. And, you know, he's not going to do another one now. This is the definitive story.
And it's a beautiful book, and it's got such a great cover and everything. I just think, wow, it's gorgeous. What a testament to his career. But what was this like? Because you'd written the Dave Brubeck one, obviously. This was just your work. So now you're collaborating with somebody else. Yeah. What was the differences in the process for you as a writer?
It was simply my techniques and his material. So, I quite like to mess with chronology. I hate the idea of biographies that start with people, you know, with people's birth, and then sort of 400 pages later they keel over. I kind of hate that. So I do like to mess with chronology. And the book, the Dave Davis book, starts with him. He had a big health crisis in 2003. He had a stroke and was in hospital for about 2-3 months. And he said that was the first time he'd really had, you know, he'd really had the time to kind of stop and think about his life and his career. And, you know, a little kind of bell went off in my head, and I thought that's the perfect start to the book. So the book actually starts with him in hospital. Well, with, you know, with what happened with the health crisis, then him in hospital and trying to recover, and this idea of, you know, remembering what's actually a memory and what's a sort of forgotten thing that never happened and all this kind of stuff, which biographers have to deal with all the time. That's where the book starts, and then it sort of, you know, and then it goes back to, you know, Muswell Hill in the 50s and his birth and all the rest of it. Mm-hmm. I've forgotten the question.
I just wondered what it was like as a writing process. Collaboration.
I mean, it's like all of these things, once you get into the groove and the rhythm, it's sort of, you know, it just, it develops its impetus, and eventually it's a sort of sprint to the finish, as you will no doubt know, you know, it's a sprint to the finish, and eventually you get it done.
All my subjects are long dead when I start writing about them.
So, fascinating, working
with somebody who's going to see it, approve it. I think it must be such a fascinating idea, collaborating.
Yeah, I mean, I'd love to do it again. I mean, I wouldn't. Again, it pays well. So that's another reason. It's increasingly hard to make a living as a writer, and it pays well. I'd do it as a mercenary thing. I mean, one of the great things about at the book was, as I say, when I met my wife, we moved to East Finchley, and East Finchley neighbours at Muswell Hill, and the street we lived, it was just a couple of blocks, as it were, from where Dave and Ray were born. And it was, for the first time in my life, I moved to a place and then discovered a music I really liked to do with the place. And then normally the way is, you know, I like your music and then I go to the place and discover it. And with the Kinks, it was the other way around. But it did mean when I came to write the book, and he mentioned, you know, the place he met his first girlfriend, a park in Muswell Hill, I knew exactly where that was. And I just sort of had the sort of grain and the fabric of the place, you know, at my fingertips. And had the Ringo Starr, a phoned up and said, "Will you do my autobiography?" Of course, I wouldn't have said no. But I have absolutely no feel for Liverpool at all. I mean, I've never been there, in fact. So that would have been a very sort of different project. But there was just something about the intimacy I felt with the music and with the place. It just made it such a joy to work on. Yeah. And I think he felt a certain comfort with that, because he didn't have to keep explaining where everything was in Muswell Hill and how it related to each other. There's a cat fighter going on outside my studio.
Well, I'm sure if you put it on Twitter afterwards, I'm sure you'll get lots of musicians commenting. Yeah. So you're doing an event with him in New York.
I am. So the book is released in New York in April. I think it's already out, actually, but we're doing the launch in April. At a Rough Trade, April the 3rd, which is in Rockefeller Center now, apparently. Used to be in Brooklyn. So yeah, we did a couple in London when it came out here. So it's sort of me on stage with Dave, just reminiscing about here's a life in the Kinks and his music and the process of writing the book.
And you've got another very different event coming up in London. I'm going to put this into the chat.
Yeah.
Anybody who wants to go to it, you can look on the British Library website. Tell us about this. What a very different event.
Yes, well, this is a talk. This is a sort of in conversation evening I'm doing with Sarah Churchwell, who's written a fantastic book about Gone with the Wind. And she sort of unpicked all the history of Gone with the Wind, all the kind of horrendous sort of racial undertones, and how the kind of the ideas in the book, how they've all sort of reappeared again with, you know, sort of Trump and January the 6th and all that kind of stuff. And she's made, you know, sort of very explicit links, between this, you know, the world that Gone with the Wind describes and how it's all come back in America. It's a really... it's a book which, I mean, it reads like a sort of cracking adventure story. It just sort of pulls you through, and then you realise, my God, this is so depressing and so concerning. And then, and how possibly can America ever get itself out of this, you know, out of this situation it's in, where, you know, the country is just so polarised, and, you know, it's sort of flip flops between different extremes. So that's what we're talking about.
And how did you come to be the person asked to do this? Did you know Sarah personally, or was it something?
So last year they run an annual award, the Eccles, it's the Eccles Centre and Hay Festival Writers Award, which I won. It's at the 2022 award I won, and you get some money and you get a residency at the British Library. And Sarah won it. I don't know, Jim. I think she won it sort of 5 or 6 years ago. So I was asked to do it a bit because of that. And the idea of the award is it's not a retrospective, you know, sort of merit badge for a book you've written. It's to support an ongoing book. And so I'm writing this book at the minute. It's a history of the sound of New York called A Sound in the City. And the award was to support that. And I've got about another year to go on writing that.
So while you're writing it, are you finding that you're composing music as well?
No, not at all. I can't do both. It's just there's just not enough hours in the day. So
do you miss that when you're writing books? Do you miss the music?
I don't miss the composing now, but I do miss the improvisation. I have to say, I came across some CDRs a few days ago of some gigs I'd done just before the pandemic, and listened to them, and I thought, oh my goodness, I really want to get back into this, but writing a book is just it's just such an encompassing thing. It just never leaves you alone. From the second day you wake up to the second day you go to bed, it's just there all the time, and it's just just something had to give, and that's the thing that's sort of gone at the minute. But I would at some point in the future like to go back to it.
So we've got quite a few aspiring writers as members on Goldster. So tell us, what is your writing routine like? What's your kind of, do you have a normal day, or does it vary from day to day?
Yeah, well, I mean, this morning I was at my desk at 5.
That's very impressive.
Very impressive, yeah. Used to be earlier when I was younger. But I just find if I can start at 5 and do a sort of, I mean, I come downstairs at 7 and the kids are waiting for breakfast and all that kind of stuff. But if I can get sort of a couple of hours done between sort of 5 and 7, that just kind of sets me up for the day. It just sort of sets my groove going.
And do you set yourself a certain number of words or a certain task for the day, or do you just allow it to happen organically?
I mean, I try and hit 600 or 700 words a day, which what you don't want to do is I say I'm going to write sort of 3,000 words a day, because that never happens. But sort of 600, 700 is manageable. It's achievable. And actually, if you start at 5 in the morning, I sort of write almost without thinking about it at that time. It's as soon as you become conscious of the fact you're writing anything, that's when little insecurities that come in and you can't quite sort of find the right adjective or whatever. But if you sort of write almost when you're still asleep and it's sort of been churning around your brain all night, I just find that sometimes it just spills out a bit, before I've realized it. But I try and, I get up at 5, I go downstairs at 7, cook sausages or whatever for the kids. And my wife, her takes them out at 8 to school, and then I come back to my desk and work until about sort of 12 or 1 o'clock, or I write until 12 at 1 o'clock. And then normally at that point, I just have to leave at the house. I'm just so sort of fed up with the sight of my desk and everything to do with it. So that's the point. I normally go to a cafe, and that's, the afternoon is sort of when I do lots of reading either reading or admin to do with the book. But certainly, there are so many documents, to read, when you're writing a big book, and so many so many sources, and that's the time I do that sort of work. Yeah. I think a lot of writers, you hear this a lot, they're trying to write in the afternoon is just absolutely impossible.
I think in general people kind of feel lower, that have lower energy in the afternoon. I know a lot of people have
that's
said
that you need to break.
I'm quite rubbish between about 2 and 4 p.m.
Yeah, exactly. It's about 2 o'clock in the afternoon.
Yeah, to do any writing.
Well, I mean, I've got a good friend who's a writer, and he sort of ambles out of bed about 11 o'clock, and then sort of writes until about sort of at tea time, and then he does more into the evening, and whatever works, of course.
Yeah, absolutely.
And he doesn't have children, but that for me is the way it works, and it's somehow it's just the way it's always worked. It just feels very, and I really like being up early in the morning.
I like, particularly in winter when it's sort of really cold and you sort of, you know, you sort of crank the heating up and get some tea going, and it just feels very sort of wholesome. And ideas flow incredibly well at that sort of time. In a way, they just don't at sort of at 2 o'clock in the afternoon.
And so, looking at your upcoming book,
yeah,
how are you doing the research for The Sounds of New York? I mean, are you spending a lot of time in New York and recording it? Would you walk around just making notes?
Yeah. So I've been doing lots of research trips to New York, and I'm going again in about 3 weeks' time. Well, doing the Dave Davis thing as a side thing. Yeah, so I've spent a lot of time, sort of pacing the sidewalks there, basically. And the first chapter of the book begins in the 1920s with the composer Edgar Varèse, who was born in Air France. And when he was in Air France, he was quite successful and wrote sort of big, sort of neo-romantic, sort of Richard Strauss-like orchestral pieces, all of which were lost or burnt or whatever. And then he moved to New York he arrived in New York beginning of 1916. And the sound of the city just completely changed everything to do with his music. And he just destroyed all the kind of European romanticism and started, to write these pieces that incorporated the sounds of sirens and steamboat whistles and kind of structures that somehow had dealt with just the shape of the city and the kind of expanse of the city. And he wrote a piece called Amérique, which had its premiere in the beginning of 1926. And at the same time, there was an author, John Dos Passos, who wrote a book called Manhattan Transfer, which is sort of the sort of great modernist novel about New York. It's the American sort of a Ulysses in a sense. And I realized a few years ago, and this is where the book sort of really started, that Amérique and the Manhattan Transfer were essentially exactly the same ideas about, you know, sort of landscape and cities and all that. One of which happens to be, realized in sound, and the other happens to be realized as a novel. And when you actually begin the novel and hear the start of the orchestral piece, it's almost like they are the same thing, because they start off on the kind of horizons of New York in the sort of harbor, and then sort of gradually move inwards. And Varèse's piece, it's a very sort of a collage and episodic, and you're sort of, you know, the music is going that way, and then suddenly it turns on itself in a completely opposite direction without any transition whatsoever. And the Dos Passos novel that does exactly the same thing. And my first research trip, which literally gave me tendonitis, and I was sort of hobbling around when I got back for about a month, was sort of walking just between all the places they lived to, you know, just to see, you know, how connected they were, and just to get a feel for the sort of neighborhoods in which they lived, because I wanted to try and establish whether they ever met. And I did lots of research, and I've unearthed they have lots and lots of mutual friends.
Right.
And they went to lots and lots of the same sort of bars and sort of salons. There were lots of sort of artist salons in those days where, artists could go and meet and talk and eat very cheaply. And I've got, I've got letters from Dos Passos, to say he was in this particular salon. And then there's documentary evidence that Varèse went to the same place, but I can't find any a suggestion they ever met.
But gosh, how frustrating, because you'd love to be able to just get that connection going.
Well, what I do in the book is what I found is they for a good sort of two or three months, so they were literally living within a block of each other. Varèse was writing his orchestral piece, John Dos Passos was writing his novel. The same ideas, one is sound, one is a novel, but they had no idea of each other's existence. That's what I think. Yeah. But I do in the book, I sort of imagine a meeting between them and the sort of conversation they would have had about, how they thought about, what the experience of being in New York had done to their sense of, sort of pace and structure and Dos Passos was actually very articulate about music, and he knew the music of Debussy and Stravinsky. He spent a lot of time in Paris, and Debussy and Stravinsky were two of Varese's sort of big inspirations and big idols. So I sort of imagined this conversation between them. That's how that chapter sort of ends. And then after the 1920s, there's a big, as I said earlier, I like to mess with chronology. And there's a big flashback to the Ice Age, basically. Wow. And I kind of explore, the big sort of area that became New York was kind of scooped out by the ice and became the sort of big sort of resonating chamber of sound. And I did a walk right up to the northern tip of the island to Inwood Hill Park, which is one of the earliest unspoilt neighborhoods of New York. And you can see, rock formations there from 50,000 years ago. And you look over into the Bronx and you see, there's a rock formation there that's a billion years old. And I wanted just to establish really, the bedrock of the city and just to get those absolute sort of fundamentals in place. And you realize actually, these rock formations that are tens of thousands of years old, actually that's why, because they sort of landed in a midtown, that's why you can put skyscrapers there. Whereas if you put skyscrapers there further downtown, they just go into the kind of spongier spongier soil. And of course, the way the buildings are arranged, does have an impact on the way sound sort of moves and bounces around at the city. So it's actually all pertinent to the subject.
But and how much longer have you got on this book? When do you have to have it finished by? And when will it be?
April, end of April next year.
Right. Yeah. Well, good luck with it. We're almost out of time. Thank you so much today, Philip. It was great to talk to you.
Pleasure.
Good luck with the books that are already out, the one that you're still writing, which sounds amazing. Thank you very much for coming along to Goldster Inside Story today.
It's a pleasure. I really enjoyed it. And thank you to everyone who came and listened.
And just to tell everybody that what is coming up, so tomorrow I'm back with you and I am going to be interviewing Natalie Jenner, who is the author. She's a novelist and she's the author of two books, The Jane Austen Society and The Bloomsbury Girls, both of which are novels. And I think she's just done an amazing job. She's joining us from Canada. And then Humphrey is back with you next week. He's interviewing John and Mary James on the Thursday the 16th and Jack Barsky on the 17th of March. And I also wanted to tell you about next Tuesday. I'm going to be back with you on PPG and I'm interviewing an Austrian documentary maker. Her name is Valerie Blankenbill. She has done the most fascinating documentary called The Bubble. It's a portrayal of the world's largest retirement center in Florida. It's absolutely fascinating. And you can actually watch the trailer. You can actually watch the film for free on YouTube, which I will share all that with you next Tuesday, the 14th of March. So thank you so much, everybody, for coming along. Thank you for your messages. Another interesting guest. Thanks, Lucinda. Thank you for that one. There you are, Philip. That's one for you. And I will see you all tomorrow. Take care, everybody, and have a great week. Bye.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this Goldster podcast, where we aim to bring you great interviews, to expand your world, and to keep you curious. Please look us up at www.goldster.co.uk and don't forget to subscribe to the podcast.